And we will move on to the third case for this morning, Scruggs. I'm not sure whether to call this Garst Seed Company or Syngenta, but Garst, I'll say. Scruggs versus Garst.
Whatever.
Yeah. Mr. Kendall?
May it please the court, Mr. Wood. Sunday was 44 years since the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed, which made this case possible. And this year is 21 years since the decision in the trilogy called Celotex that made this summary judgment decision even remotely possible. And it was only in December of this last year that Benazir Bhutto posthumously had a book published in which she observed that women in any kind of a public setting, in work or anywhere else, have to always wear some sort of a mask, not only in her society, but in Western society, because if they stray from that mask too far, they are either going to be labeled weak or troublesome, to use a polite word.
That seems a bit far flung for this case. You're not asking us to second guess the Supreme Court's Celotex trilogy, I trust.
No.
That's okay.
And the reason I don't, with all respect, think it's far fetched is because I think that the tipping point in this case was when Dana Scruggs took her mask off and went to the U.S. EEOC on December 2nd of 2004 and filed an EEOC charge. Because up to that point, the company had tolerated a discriminatory and hostile work environment, had even planned to act on it and get rid of Beezer, who was the supervisor perpetrating most of it, and get rid of Glover because they decided he was incompetent and lazy, and published a written memorandum to that effect on May 2nd of 2004.
But let me ask you this, since you raised this December 4 EEOC charge. In that, she states that she immediately contacted Agrippa when her doctor released her to return to work in November of 2004. Instead of restoring her to her previous position, she was further retaliated against and told that there was no job for her and she was terminated, end quote. Does this statement indicate that she knew as early as November of 2004 that her position was being eliminated?
No. What it means is that they gave her some difficulty about coming back to work. She didn't know what was going on, and that surfaced in the EEOC charge. But after she filed it, they let her come back to work, and she came back on December 22nd.
I wanted to continue with this because I take it, you may disagree with me, but by starting with what I understand to be your retaliation claim, perhaps you're indicating you think that's a particularly strong claim, but there's evidence in the record that suggests that Syngenta, as part of the process of purchasing this company, was thinking long before Ms. Scruggs filed that EEOC complaint that it was going to restructure this facility. And however unpleasant Mr. Beezer was, and he certainly doesn't seem to be too good, if they were already thinking of restructuring, then to go ahead and restructure can't really be retaliation for an EEOC complaint.
I think if you take the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, the head of HR and the corporate directors say in May that they need to get rid of Glover because he's incompetent.
But what evidence is there that Syngenta was adopting everything that its predecessor company was doing? I mean, maybe the Syngenta people looked at this and said, we need to sweep with a new broom here.
Because if you look at a couple of reasons. If you look at the email traffic in January 25th to January 28th, about 50 days after the EEOC charge. HR and the supervisor and the directors consciously set out to find a job title that she's never done before. Not just a job title, not just restructure it, but they set out to systematically restructure it in a way that she can't qualify.
Now, what causes the link between that act, which I agree with you happens, they rethink this job, they decide it's going to be a salaried job, they come up with a different title, and they have a job description, which arguably she satisfies, I understand it includes experience, but how can you be sure that, or what evidence would allow a trier of fact to believe that this restructuring was for the purpose of pushing out Ms. Scruggs?
I think that the reason is because they say in the email that if we pick this particular title, it's one she's never done before, and that they filled the slot with Glover, who before she filed the EEOC charge, they had deemed someone they needed to terminate because he was incompetent. And I think that the fact that they set out to specifically restructure it to something she's never done before is grounds for the jury to conclude that that was the motive. They were trying to create a position that she couldn't qualify for. In addition...
But she did nominally qualify for this, since it seems to have required either degrees or equivalent work experience and tenure in office. She had been working there for a very long time.
Yes. And internally, there's a contradiction. Worrell says in his testimony and his affidavit that they didn't hire because she had to have a BA for the job. The job, as they posted, says she has to have a BA, but the job description actually says BA or experience.
Or experience, right. Would there be anything wrong if they wanted a BA? I thought companies were entitled to establish qualifications as they wished.
No, there's nothing wrong with the BA. There's nothing wrong with that concept. The problem is that these same people met in March and April by phone and issued a written memo in May of 2004 saying that we need to get rid of Glover. We're going to offer him a $5,000 severance package because he's incompetent. They put it in writing in May of 2004. Then, because they're asleep at the switch, they turn around and reissue and re-gift the memo in February of 2005, signed by the HR director, forget to change the dates in the memo, saying it's going to be effective July 1 of 2004, give that to us in discovery, and then we get the real May memo at a deposition. And I think that that is enough ambiguity, timing, and disparate treatment to undermine their pretextual reason for doing this, at least to make it a question of fact for a jury as to why they did this and what was the real motive in doing this.
There's also a question. The district court was of the view that Glover is not in a comparable position to Ms. Scruggs because of his degree in agronomy and the kinds of work that he did wasn't, in fact, as equivalent or similar as you argue that it was.
Your Honor, I think that from the very beginning, the testimony, again, of Scruggs' own officials says that, first of all, that she was actually doing Glover's work, and that Glover was lazy, and she was doing everything he was doing, and it demonstrated the skill.
That's her testimony. Is there any other testimony to that effect?
No, that's not her testimony. It's the testimony of Worrell. Pardon, Your Honor. My passion's getting ahead of my courtesy here. In the notes and email traffic in 2004, Worrell, the supervisor, and Horrigan, the HR head, say that she is doing Glover's job, that she is, quote, the glue, close quote, holding the facility together, and then they proceed to identify Beezer as a nutcase, Glover as incompetent and washed up, and then they call her either troublemaker or whistleblower, either the most competent employee or a thorn in their side. But they had come down eventually on getting rid of Glover because he's not competent. They say, then Horrigan and Beezer himself in their depositions say there's no difference in these job titles. There's no difference in what they do based on the job titles, and she was doing what he was doing, and they were all doing it interchangeably. So I think the idea that they're not similarly situated is false.
Let me ask you this. What, other than the fact that she is female, would allow someone to infer that all of this is because of her sex as opposed to just, you know, maybe a dysfunctional management structure or something? Your opponent suggests that in the end it's actually quite some months after the restructuring before she's finally told she's not going to have the job.
Well, I think that...
It doesn't discriminate to have a bad management structure and make silly decisions. So you need some evidence to show us that it's because of her sex or because of the EEOC complaint for the retaliation.
I think that the run-up to the EEOC charge showed a willingness of management to tolerate the hostile working environment that they knew was gender-based. And they didn't even act on their May memo, and Horgan testified he doesn't know why they didn't do anything about it after they issued it. Then after the EEOC charge, I think that the evidence that the motive is retaliation and not per se gender is the fact that they did it in such quick proximity to it happening, and the email traffic showing that they kind of ganged up to decide how can we create a title that she's never held so she just can't hang on here. Thank you.
Okay. You can save the rest for rebuttal. Mr. Wood.
May it please the Court and Counsel. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Wood, I have just a technical question. In your disclosure statement, you list 10 parent corporations. So is Garst Seed actually a separate corporation, or is it a division of Syngenta at this point?
It is a separate corporation, Your Honor.
Separate corporation. And it's owned by which one of these Syngentas?
That's Syngenta Seed, Inc.
All right. So number 3 is... And the others are affiliates of some type?
Correct, or parent companies all the way up.
Parents of parents, okay.
Right. Your Honor, I'd like to just correct one thing. I think Mr. Kendall said that he was mistaken on. I think he said that there was evidence in the record from my client to show that Ms. Scruggs was qualified for this position. And he referenced this claim or this statement that she was the glue that held the place together. And this is actually in tab 21 of his appendix. It's not numbered, but it's Garst number at the bottom, 340. What it actually says is technician dash, glue that holds the gap together, but not skilled to move up. That's what the comment is by this situation. Comment just prior to that, by the way, is this is a dysfunctional unit, which is pretty obvious from the record. So I would like to just address a couple of the issues that the court raised and that Mr. Kendall raised. I think Mr. Kendall has focused on his retaliation claim, and I think that the evidence is very clear that there were two issues involved here. One was the decision to restructure and eliminate her position, and then the second was the decision who to hire for the restructured position.
And didn't the announcement about the restructure occur in May of 2004?
No, in May of 2004, there was a memo that came out that said, because they were looking at this dysfunctional unit, and they said, this is what we think we're going to do. They considered a number of different options. One of the options that they considered was wiping the slate clean and starting all over again. But they considered a number of different options. So that wasn't a decision. Actually, in May of 2004, there were discussions that were being held. That's when the discussion started on, looks like Syngenta's going to buy Garst. Let's start looking at the issue of how we restructure all these things. And that's in Mr. Worrell's affidavit that we've submitted to you in our appendix. In his affidavit, he's very clear that over the course of a number of months up through September, they were talking about that. And then in September, the documents were finally signed. The deal wasn't closed yet, but the documents were signed. So they started moving forward with that, and they made the decision to restructure prior to December of 2004 when Ms. Scruggs filed her charge. Now, Ms. Scruggs wouldn't know that, obviously. She wasn't there, first of all. She was on medical leave. She wasn't even in the office. But she wasn't a decision maker. So there's no evidence that she's presented to you that says, I know this decision was made afterwards because here's what somebody says. In fact, the only evidence in the record of that is Mr. Worrell's affidavit that says, no, it was made prior to December. I think, Judge Williams, you hit on the issue, which is what caused Ms. Scruggs in December to all of a sudden file an EEOC charge? What was the cause of that? The cause of it was because what Mr. Worrell said in November of 2004, he called and left her a message because he couldn't reach her and said, we're restructuring your position and effectively we're going to restructure the facility and you'll have a chance to interview for a position, but yours is gone. That's what leads her to file a charge in early December. And that's the comment that effectively was made in her charge, which is, my job's been eliminated. I don't have a job anymore.
She does. I mean, the language in her charge certainly sounds like that. She does testify, though, that, if I recall, that she received no phone calls or messages during November. Don't we need to accept her word for that at this stage of the proceeding?
I think, Judge, you don't for a couple reasons. One is you can look to her charge statements, which are sworn under oath. Mm-hmm. And if she says that on December 2nd she thought her position was being eliminated, there had to be a basis for that. Someone had to tell her that. And so there had to be something that happened there. So her testimony is inconsistent with her sworn charge as to what happened. And so ultimately, no, I don't think you have to. But even if you do, it doesn't go to the issue of the decision versus the notice to her. Okay, the decision was made prior to December. There's no dispute over that. Okay, and that's the first issue she has. You eliminated my position because of my charge. Well, we couldn't have eliminated it because of the charge because we made that decision prior to the charge coming about. So as a matter of law, there can be no way that we did that. Then the other issue is you didn't hire me for this restructured position. That's 4 months later. That's in April, after we've interviewed five people out of approximately 20 candidates. Okay. We've cited to you a number of cases that deal with the issue of, you know, how long do you need to have? When does this timing issue that Mr. Kendall raises, when does the timing become suspect here from the standpoint that it works against the plaintiff? And that the Filipovic case had a four-month separation.
But my understanding, anyway, of Mr. Kendall's point is that this isn't really just about the time between the restructuring and the eventual decision to hire Mr. Glover. It's really something that happens immediately when they decide to repackage the job, if you will, make it a salary job, change the requirements. And in a sense, it looked to me like the setting her up to fail kind of theory. So if that's the case, you know, your timing argument is much tighter.
Well, but that decision had already been made, Judge, prior to this. I mean, if you look at what Mr. Worrell says in his affidavit, they made the decision to restructure not just this facility, okay? So they made the decision to restructure four or five different facilities because of this merger. They were all going to the same format. All exempt positions, no non-exempt positions. They even closed the Jonesboro facility. So to believe his argument, you have to believe that because of one female employee in a three-person facility over here, they chose to restructure a number of facilities, reduce their work count by about seven or eight people, close one plant or one facility, all because of what she says. And I would take issue with what Mr. Kendall said with respect to this email traffic in January. If you look at the email traffic, what they're trying to do is figure out, okay, what job does she have? What are we going to do with, what's this new job going to look like? Okay, it's not necessarily dealing with Ms. Scruggs alone, as Mr. Kendall and Ms. Scruggs would like you to believe that everything that Syngenta did during this time frame was focused just because of her. That's not true. They're a multinational company. And they were making decisions on what's this position going to look like. That would obviously be something you do. It didn't have any issue with respect to whether it was going to be the research tech position she had or the assistant position. It was an issue of what's it going to look like? What's the traffic? Or, you know, what effectively is this job going to be?
You know, all of that may be true. I just want to comment that when you have a person like Mr. Beezer accepting what she says he was saying over the years, and a company doesn't do anything about it, people have trouble believing that these innocent explanations are right, you know, to be demeaning and talk about cookie sprinkles and that kind of thing saps confidence from the workplace.
A couple of comments on that, Judge. First of all, Mr. Beezer had nothing to do with the decision-making process on eliminating her position or hiring her. So regardless of what Mr. Beezer said or didn't say, he lost his position. Okay? So he was gone. Secondly, I think that if you look at the chronology of events, you'll see that effectively she never complained about most of this stuff. And this happened over years, but this happened, you know, she's going back to times when Syngenta, Garst never even owned AgriPro. She's going back to 1995. We had nothing to do with it at that point in time, not just Syngenta, but Garst. Garst didn't buy it until 2001. Mm-hmm. So we inherited all this stuff. And between 2001 and 2004, when you look at her testimony, I asked her, did you complain about this? No. Did you complain about this? No. She doesn't complain until June of 2003, where she reports the cookies with sprinkles comment. That's what she reports. I think she also reports at that point in time that she thought that Beezer had struck an employee at that point in time. Right. Yeah. And that's when they start talking to her and dealing with her. But she doesn't disclose all of this past stuff. She doesn't disclose any of the other information. She reports that issue.
Does the company have a written policy about reporting such things?
Yes, Your Honor. It's in our appendix. We provided you that. And she admits that it was there. I've dropped a footnote in my brief on that. She knew about it. She understood how to use it. She just didn't use it. So when you look at the situation, how is the company supposed to know about all this conduct out in Brookston, Illinois, with three people, unless she's reporting it? She understands she could, and she understands she should have, but she didn't. And in many cases, when you look at what she did report, it wasn't discrimination. She reported, you know, Mr. Beezer did this, and I don't like the way he did this. Okay, that's not a report of discrimination. That's just a report of I don't like what he's doing.
But what about her claim that she was not permitted to interview for the research assistant position between 95 and 2001 and not paid for overtime between 97 and 2001? When did those complaints come to light?
In her EEOC charge.
So in terms of notice to the company, no notice on that either?
I don't believe, Your Honor. I think she complained about her pay. What she was complaining about in 2003 was, she claims that in 2003, in June, she got job duties that she thought she shouldn't have. Okay. Now, similarly, in January of 2003, those job duties were taken away from her, and she complains about the fact that those were taken away. So I don't know whether she wanted them or didn't want them, but that's the complaint. She certainly never complained about, I haven't been paid like this for years. And effectively, she certainly didn't ask, you know, that was a decision that was made last in 2001 with respect to the research assistant position. She didn't file an EEOC charge within 300 days of that happening. And she certainly didn't deal with that in any way. And I think, obviously, under the Ledbetter decision, that certainly shows that, you know, the effects of it may have continued on, but the decision was made here. And even if you looked at the issue of what happened in June of 2003 with respect to her getting additional duties that she claimed she should have been paid for, that's still not within the 300-day time frame. She didn't file any charge on that. So she can't come back now and say, you know, I should do that. The other issue is that those were taken away in January of 2003, again, prior to the 300-day time frame even happening. So she had ample opportunity to file these charges and pursue them. She just never did. I think on the harassment issue, I would just make a couple of quick comments. And let me step back for one second and say, on the issue of the statute of limitations, I mean, if you look at her interrogatory answers, you have very specific dates on which Mr. Beezer allegedly did things. And then there's huge gaps between time frames. There's a year, over a year in one time. There's 7 months. There's 5 months. These were discrete things that she claims Mr. Beezer did.
If one is reading her complaint sympathetically, you might say these are four examples. I thought she was saying that this was maybe not as severe a bit of harassment. I like to think of the Chinese water torture. It's a little bit here, it's a little bit there. It's a rude comment, belittling behavior, and that it's just pervasive. I thought she was saying that.
I don't know if she said that in her complaint, Judge, but I asked her in her deposition transcript, in her deposition, and it's in the transcript that I provided. I said, here are your interrogatory responses, because they run, quite frankly, they run from, I think, page 98 of my appendix through page 113, where she lists all these issues. I said, is this it? Is this all you're complaining about? Are these all the things that you're complaining about? Tell me if there's anything else.
So suppose she had said, well, I can't say anything, but every day, you know, his attitude was demeaning or something. If she had said something like that, would you think that would be enough to preserve the issue?
Judge, I don't think so for the reason that, well, she may have been able to do that. First of all, she didn't say that. She said, this is it.
Right,
this is all I've got.
Trying to figure out how you show. I mean, people don't necessarily commit to memory what happens every single day in
no.
the job.
Right. I agree, Your Honor. And I think that effectively, yeah, that's one way she could have done it. She could have said, these are examples. Okay. I asked her, are these the specific dates? Is this what happened? Yes, this is it. This is what happened. Okay. Now, the other issue on that from the harassment or discrimination standpoint or the harassment standpoint is effectively that when you look at the case law, nothing that Mr. Beezer does, as objectionable as it is to us as individuals and humans, rises to the level of harassment. He didn't touch her. He didn't put his hands on her private areas.
But that may not be necessary. If he went to work every day and he said, women are only good for making coffee, I mean, that's not offensive touching or something, but if day in and day out he belittled her based on her gender, I think the law suggests that that would be actionable. I'm not saying that's what's in this record, but I'm just trying to clarify here.
I think, Judge, it depends on the severity or pervasiveness. It's got to be severe or pervasive. I don't think it would. I don't know that that would meet either. It's not the case here, and so obviously you don't have to get to that issue.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Kendall?
I don't know how much time I have left, but hoping
Four
I have.
Minutes.
Oh, great. Thank
Four
you.
4 minutes.
I think a couple of good questions that were asked here were about when this decision was made to restructure and what that means. The management, the highest management of this corporation, is on the phone with the head of HR for the entire corporation, board members, heads of whole divisions, about Dana Scruggs and Beezer in the spring of 2004. And they chew on this and chew on this and chew on this and finally issue a memo in May that Harold Horrigan testified was a decision-making memo and accurately reflected their decision to get rid of Beezer, to get rid of Glover because he was incompetent, and to give Glover a $5,000 severance, and to promote her, to consider promoting her to research technician, whatever that means. These job descriptions you'll find mean nothing inside this company. But turns out later they decide she is a research technician, and they're going to create a new position that she can't qualify for. In January of 2005, the head of the wheat division, the head of HR for the entire corporation, two other board members are emailing back and forth. One of them, Rel or Bruns, says, I've looked through all of our records since 1987. These are all the job titles we've ever used. This is one we've never used for her. Does this do the job? And then they go back and forth, and finally they pick a title. Now, whenever you, if it were not for email traffic and the notes of Mr. Horrigan, we would not know all of this. But because of it, we know. It isn't that they decided to restructure in January or December or May. They start talking about restructuring the site in May of 2004 before Syngenta's in the picture, because they can't close it down. They think about getting rid of everybody, including her, because they say she's a troublemaker. But they can't afford to lose all the skills. Which is why when they decide not to get rid of Beezer and Glover after she files her EEOC charge, they've got to keep Glover. They dump Beezer, and they create a situation where she can't succeed and she can't pass. Their credibility is zero. In the affidavit of Mr. Horrigan, signed under oath, prepared by his attorneys, he denies, does not list Fogelman as involved in the decision to hire her, to get rid of her. He shows up at the deposition and says it wasn't Fogelman, it was a committee of three and we all voted. And Fogelman signs an affidavit later saying, I made the decision all by myself. I think that this is an example of direct evidence of these people admitting what they're doing, captured electronically, and leaving no doubt why they set it up the way they did. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Thank you. We will take the case under advisement.